No, you tell it.
No, you.
I'm not telling it.
You should totally tell it.
Well, you should tell it.
No, you tell it. No, You Tell It is a series that switches up the storytelling. So each performer writes a true life tale and then, switching with a partner, performs the other person's story, giving everyone involved the chance to share their own stories and experience someone else's.
In the second half of our Hellgate show, founding member and story director Erica Iverson interviews the authors before their story partners take the stage so we can learn a little bit more about them and the inspiration for their true tales, The Hellgate Bridge.
I've done this part in a long time. I'm really happy to be here. The last show here, I double-checked. I think it's the only No You Tell It show that I wasn't present for, and it's because I was out of the country. So I'm really happy to be back, and I'm taking over this half of the show. So, Alicia, I wanted to get to know you a little bit. You are a composer and a conductor.
Yes.
Which is so cool. And I know not many people, but I do know people who are composers, but I think you are the first person I've met in real life who is a professional conductor. Can you tell us a little bit about your path there and like what you love about it?
Sure. The short story is you wave your hands and then the music stops. The long story is, you know, I was at first trained as a composer and then I thought, oh, one day I want to conduct my own orchestral piece and I want to know what I'm doing because it's clearly more than just flapping your arms. And so I started learning, I started taking lessons, but I did not expect to kind of get bit by this bug, which there's probably a few artists in here, so they probably understand. And so I had a second bug, so composition was the first, conducting is the second, but I've discovered on this path that actually, like, you get paid as a conductor.
Mm-hmm. Oh!
It's been quite a journey, and it is kind of one of those fields where people stay in their position forever.
Yeah.
And so, in a kind of a morbid sense, you're just like waiting for people to die. But no, I mean, it's of course it's an art form that is just so vast, and it's so much more complex than it looks. And I'll probably not learn all the rap that I want to, you know, over the course of the rest of my life. But you know, it's awesome.
I just think that's so cool. I feel privileged to work with you, and now I get to read. Ooh, a very long question. After the main arch of the Hellgate Bridge was completed, a writer for the New York Tribune said, "Perhaps never in human history has a mechanical triumph of such magnitude been launched with so little fanfare."
Yep.
As amazing as it is, the Hellgate Bridge is often overlooked. What is a marvel of Queens, big or small, that you think is overlooked?
So it's funny, I just had a friend over from out of town, and you know, he was like, "I want to see the Unisphere." Okay, great. Like, we went to the Unisphere. But I was like, "But let's go eat all the amazing food that's here."
Yes.
So, like, I took him to Flushing, and you know, we get off the 7 train and his eyes are like, you know, boing, like. So I just think that the immigrant community and the culture and the diversity that is here is just unparalleled, spectacular, and underrated.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah. I love that. Well, on that note, here is The Bridge to the Bridge by Alicia Liu and performed by A. King McCarty.
The Bridge to the Bridge. I used to always feel like I was a bridge. I was a link to Chinese culture. I had to be a feat of engineering that could instantaneously construct itself in the presence of anyone who requested a crossing. It was exhausting. Especially when I was only Asian American and ABC, American-born Chinese, and not the real deal. I grew up in Silicon Valley, where the wave of immigrant engineers meant that my classes were 40% Asian, enough to bring high visibility to the presence of a culture that was not white. This led to people feeling uncomfortable or threatened by the influx of Asians. This perceived threat has been documented and dubbed as the new white flight. In fact, I just looked up the demographics for my high school, Lynbrook High School, and is now 80% Asian. Isn't that interesting? I wonder if that would upend a white student's ethnic identity journey, growing up as a minority in the United States. I was often treated by my classmates and their parents like an outsider, making fun of my small, almond-shaped eyes, or commenting on my mother's imperfect English, while other times they would be inquisitive about Chinese food and customs. Being asked to educate those same people about Chinese food, language, and customs caused me to grow resentful over the years. That resentment went unchecked for a very long time and eventually caused many arguments, hurt feelings, and endangered friendships. I wasn't trying to be a mean girl. I just had developed the tools to be kind to myself and, by extension, to others. I felt like I was swimming upstream during a hurricane, and as soon as I'd get my head above water, I'd get sucked up in a tornado, only to be stuck in a vortex of unsorted, unnamed, complex emotions. I grew up in an environment where being Chinese was not mainstream or normal. So why then was I so upset when a friend said to me, "I don't see you as Chinese. I just see you as white, like me." Why was something that I was born with absolutely zero control over, sometimes a cruel curse of nature, and other times a source of comfort and refuge? I was also upset that I couldn't figure out why I was uncomfortable. At the time, I was still a destination-oriented person, not a process-oriented one. And there were times when I was ecstatic to share my culture with others. In college, I would throw dumpling-making parties, but I would only invite people who knew and appreciated, appreciated and viscerally loved them. People who would respond with a, "Oh my God, yes!" to the invitation. Looking back, I realized that there were people who knew and accepted me unconditionally for who I was, regardless if I understood my Chinese-ness or not. Besides, who can be sad at a dumpling when they're eating dumplings, right? I eventually learned to weaponize some of my responses to the white gaze. Today, when people ask me, "Where are you from?" my standard answer is California, because I want to see them navigate the awkward waters that they dove themselves into. And food, not just the comfort, became a weapon as well. After getting over the initial shame I felt at the time, I purposefully brought dumplings, made Chinese chives for lunch more frequently after colleagues in the office complained that someone's food is stinking up the fridge. And sometime after that, I brought leftovers, a fish dish that combined aromas of two spring greens. Not just fish, but fish with fermented black bean sauce. Put that in your microwave and smoke. Once I felt that high of bringing people slight discomfort that didn't physically scar them, I moved on to aromatic and pungent foods that I borrowed from other Asian cultures. Korean kimchi and Vietnamese fish sauce. To quote my Vietnamese friend, "Man, it stinks, but it's so good!" I never took it so far as to bring fermented, aka sticky tofu, to work, though it is hard for me to stand the smell myself. When I was a kid, I used to throw a tantrum and lock myself in my bedroom when my mom cooked it because I couldn't take the smell of it. But I absolutely love Chinese chives, kimchi, and fish sauce. It freshens up any office. They should collectively be called GLADE, Asian Aromatics. Today, as I watch TikTokers and Instagrammers post videos about cheap and delicious foods in New York that go viral, resentment resurfaces when I try to go to my longtime favorite food establishments in Flushing or Chinatown, but can't get in easily because it is overrun by tourists. I can't help but think that these people could quite possibly be the same white people who used to make fun of me and my family's smelly Chinese food.
And in my head, I'm screaming, "You don't deserve this food!" I feel the bridge collapsing. Each time the bridge collapses, though, it is actually a chance to rebuild it. Each time stronger, with new architecture and materials. Something made strong by trial and error, costing me only cyclical feelings of frustration, confusion, and self-guilt, which eventually give way to self-discovery and acceptance. It cannot be done without interacting with others. It cannot be accomplished behind closed doors. One time, someone witnessed this conversation I had while we were working together at a high-end electronics store. To avoid any potential liability, we will call it the food stand. Having just greeted and welcomed a customer into the store, she asked me, "Where are you from?" To which I answered, "Of course, California." I heard my colleague cackle. The next question from her was, "But where are you really from?" To which I answered, "Oh, San Jose." My colleague cackled again and again, louder and even louder, as this woman fumbled around for what would never be the right words. We still laugh about this to this day because we ended up together forever. And now that I have a life partner, I no longer have to do a bridge on my own. I have someone to bridge along with me. He himself is an immigrant. It is my personal bridge to a whole new world. This world contains, but is not limited to, London, transportation, and the distant world to me of setting boundaries. And fish and chips with mushy peas. His name is Pele. And no, he was not named after the famous football, that's soccer here, player. He was named that because an immigration officer misheard what his mother said, and that's what was written on his immigration papers. Pele has become my translator of British culture. Every time I see a British meme online, I send it to him and I ask if it's true. Every time we hear people from England speaking, I'll ask what part of England or London that accent is from. And he explained to me the Cockney accent and the rhyme schemes that used to always leave me with a blank look on my face, followed by a, "Huh?" Followed by a, "What did they say?" For example, with the Cockney rhyme scheme, someone would say, "On crying crackered." They're tired because crackered rhymes with knackered. Or perhaps you might hear someone say, "Can you eat them and eat it?" They actually said on National Jelly that the immigrants are eating dogs and cats. They're eating the pets! In this case, E rhymes with believe, and jelly rhymes with telly, an abbreviation for television. And then it gets even more confusing when a rhyme's created from a pair of words that is truncated. For example, instead of saying, "I am going up the stairs," they would say, "I'm going up the apples." Because the word apples is part of the phrase apples and pears, and pears up the stairs. You got it? I didn't. For a really long time, and it's probably safe to say I still don't. And now, I have to ask him what our mutual friend says over text, because I assume it is some sort of Britishism that has gone over my head. In the case with this particular friend, though, sometimes Pelly asks me what a particular text is. So, very clearly, not all Brits are the same. But I suppose that is a universal lesson we should or should have learned in life. Younger me would have liked to have been able to voice that. To tell people that they can choose to make bridges stronger instead of vandalizing them. I might actually say that in addition to being a bridge, Pele is also my train. He is my train to British culture,
a fast and efficient ride with panoramic and breathtaking views. Kelly worked for TfL, Transport for London, for nearly 2 decades. I would say that that is the equivalent of working for the MTA, but it's not. Because, well, have you ever been to London? The TfL makes the MTA system look like Kevin Hart standing next to Yao Ming. Although I'm not a Harry Potter fan per se, with Pele, it did feel somewhat magical, like having a wizard fly me around London. He'd take me down staircases very few people knew about, and when he would give me the history of the different subway lines and stations. Actually, they call it the tube there, not the subway. And they drive on the left side of the street, not the wrong side, as Americans often say. Pele had to continuously remind me to look right first when crossing the street to the left. I stepped to the edge of the sidewalk, and he put his arm out to stop me since a car was approaching from the right side. The city officials even painted the sidewalk edges with thick white letters, "Look right," with an arrow pointing right. I guess one too many tourists have gotten hit by a car in London. He said that it took him some time to get used to looking left when he first came to the States, but now it's just automatic for him. Look the right way in the right country. I rarely feel like a wizard riding the MTA, though. I, like most New Yorkers, often complain about the subway when there's a delay, but Pele translates those misunderstandings as well. Once when I said, "The board says the train is 1 minute away, but it has been 15 minutes," he said, "Sweetie, they're measuring the distance the train is from the station and converting it to minutes. It's not really minutes." Or, when I complained that the trains absolutely suck on the weekends, he said, "Sausage." New York City is the only city that has a 24/7 subway. They have to work on the track sometime. And yes, just like the French use the word cabbage as a term of endearment, the British use the word sausage. One term that Pele does not use as an endearment, however, is American tourists. He lived in the borough of Richmond in London for 4 idyllic years, right next to the Thames River. And he refused to watch Ted Lasso when it came out, even though I was completely addicted to it. And tried my darndest to give him his first hit to get him over. But even though he complained that the bloody Americans have overrun Richmond, he has been booking us Airbnbs there the last 2 times we were in London. And soon, I will actually get to stay in the Ted Lasso building for Halloween. The irony, it is not lost on me. My English gentleman sweetheart is also my bridge to Ted Lasso, even though he never watched that American abomination of London culture. And perhaps the lessons are gleaned from Ted Lasso as well as Pele. The lessons of having healthy relationships, and setting boundaries, and sticking to them. I was never really good at that, but he is. I mostly learn from observation, but sometimes he does gently suggest that I should not let people take advantage of me. I have taken that to heart, and I am getting better at it. I'm also getting better at learning the British English language. Just a few days ago, he said to me, "Don't you go calling Chiswick Chiswick when we're in London. It's Chiswick." So, I'm learning. I'm slowly crossing that bridge. The London Bridge. I used to have to put the English subtitles on whenever we'd watch a British show. We got to be hooked on murder mysteries. I was so proud of the day when I told Pele, "Babe, I don't need the subtitles anymore." Although we've been together for a good number of years, I still don't understand everything he says to me the first time. I'll have to ask him to repeat himself because what I think he said to me doesn't make sense. I hope he's not too fatigued from being my bridge to all things British. I really do hope he has endurance because he's also taking me to Sweden the week before we go to Richmond. Pele actually grew up in Gothenburg and he speaks fluent Swedish. But lucky for me, they speak a lot of English there as well. and they eat a lot of fish. I heard someone say on TikTok that some of the fish they serve in Sweden can be quite pungent. I think I just might fit in okay there.
It's my absolute pleasure. Yeah.
So, Know You Tell It is a very cool Queens-based arts organization.
Oh, yeah.
And you also are involved with some cool Queens-based arts organizations, or you have been in the past. Do you want to tell us about some of them?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I know so many. Sometimes I'm involved with them, and sometimes I just know of them. I just get to experience
them. Well, why don't you share one or two with
us? I'm with Artstoria New York. That's my organization. And we try to share things going on in Queens. So Long Island City Artists is a great one. I've made a lot of good friends from them. And there's Culture Lab. There is, oh gosh,
opening tomorrow.
What? There's an opening tomorrow?
The Culture Lab.
There's an opening tomorrow. I'm trying to share it. Now I'm not going to remember anyone. Now I'm going to be like, are there arts organizations? I'm trying to think of more. There's so many. Go to Artstoria NY on Instagram, and I try to share as much as I can. There's bookstores. Yeah. There's just amazing things.
I went down a rabbit hole on your Instagram because I was so excited. I was like, look.
I try to share as much, especially in the stories now. Like, I have a 5-year-old, so sometimes I can't share as much on the page because it's more work, but I try to share in stories anytime I see something. So please go to the Things in Queens. This is a wonderful place to live. You can walk down the street and see amazing things. Yeah. Just amazing.
Okay. And our final question.
Oh, boy.
Says, we asked this in our Hellgate Sip and Scribe. So feel free to use or change your answer. What's the strongest bridge in your life?
Oh, okay. I remember my answer, which I'm glad because I was going to freak out. The strongest bridge in my life is actually the arts. It helps me. I don't know if you can tell as I'm sitting up here, I'm kind of like freaking out a little bit. And I find that I can communicate clearer when I use any form of art. Writing, visual arts, music. It helps me connect to people. Helps me connect to people I love. It helps me connect to people I don't know. And it helps me connect to my community. So that is my strongest bridge.
Yeah. Wonderful. So, switching up, here is Under the Hellgate by A. King McCarty and performed by Alicia Liu.
Under the Hellgate. Ever since I was a child, I've been afraid of two things. One, the dark. Two, fire. I'm a woman at odds with herself, afraid of the sickness and its cure. Of course, the list of things I fear doesn't end there. I was a skittish kid. In the third grade, my teacher, as a treat, read us scary stories to tell in the dark. And after hearing the first few pages, I was given a note to be excused. I some receive a gym pass. I kept my parents up all night with the fear hauntings, and they were not keen to repeat that particular discomfort for the remainder of October. I remember the teacher's disdain, real or imagined, in small Ashley's mind as she banished me to a classroom across the hall. There I sat with students who had lost their scary story privileges, my mind ceaselessly replaying that initial tale of horror. It featured a talking cat and a dismembered head tumbling down the chimney. To this day, if I doze off near my parents' fireplace, I fill with dread, wary of a snarky cat warning me to run. I desire to be brave, like my heroes, She-Ra, the Princess of Power, or Miss Piggy. But I'm was frustrated by my lack of courage. My fear of the dark might have come from an overactive imagination. My fear of fire, however, was very real. My grandmother was my first babysitter and a firm believer in fighting fear with more fear. When I was learning to brush my teeth, my parents bought disposable Dixie cups with my favorite characters as encouragement. Delighted, I started a small collection. In retrospect, used paper cups were not the best item to keep under one's bed. They were discovered by Grandma, ever vigilant for signs of destruction, who firmly informed me that my collection would one day, without a doubt, be the cause of death for every member of my family, doomed to burn up in a fiery inferno, incited by none other than a paper cup adorned with the image of Bugs Bunny. I believed my grandma, and I loved my family, but I love my paper cups too. Instead of getting rid of them, I painstakingly packed an escape bag, a white pleather satchel filled with items I might need, and created a ritual. As I fell asleep each night, I painstakingly pored over my plan, who I would rescue, where we would go, and how I would mourn what was lost. I used the words fell asleep loosely. There were many things that kept me up at night, well beyond the threat of fire. The eyes and the wallpaper. They were flowers. The small spark in the pile of stuffed animals. A wayward firefly. And of course, eternity. I was raised Christian Methodist, and while I diligently napped through most of the sermons on my beloved grandfather's shoulder, some ideas seeped through. One, we were all gonna die. Two, if we played our cards right, we would spend eternity with Jesus. To be honest, this didn't seem very rewarding to Ashley, age 7. Late at night, staring up at the white fabric of my white canopy bed, I imagined my unending time with Christ. Just me and Jesus, sitting on a cloud. Boring to the point of horrific. But there were more pressing concerns. Yes, we were all certain to die, but there was also the option of us all dying together, spectacularly, during the end of the world, which was to come, I was told, when we least expected. It was clear to me, a child raised on preteen superheroes and spunky protagonists, that I had an important job. If the world was to end when we least expect it, then I would never stop expecting it. I expected the world to end in the shower. I expected the world to end during dinner at Denny's. I expected the world to end at my friend's sleepover while we're all learning the choreography to Bye Bye Bye. There ain't no love in the pop, pop, pop. It's no wonder I slept at all. The first time I remember feeling shame was in first grade. We were lined up like little ducks, my pigtails carefully tied in bows, when the boy behind me began bothering the girl behind him. My sense of justice, honed on stories of warrior princesses, would not stand for such bullying, and to protect her, I promptly kicked the boy in the shins. My teacher did not see the impetus of my assault, just the effect. Ms. L, famous for her fury, did not hold back. We were all frequently admonished that year, but being screamed at for hurting another student in front of my classmates caused irreparable shame. I stopped talking. I stopped laughing. I stopped defending myself. I shut down. By fifth grade, I was doing better. My mom shared with me her love of theater, and thanks to this, I gradually reemerged. I was more careful now. I didn't kick my adversaries. I was an expert of deflection, using words, art, humor, to fight my battles. The arts gave me confidence and a ticket to New York City. I thought my problems were solved, but my anxiety peaked in 2001. I was in college less than a week when September 11th happened. I was alone for the first time, my friends and family miles away. There was no easy way to contact my loved ones, and my survival tactics didn't work in this nightmare scenario. I was a child again, alone in the dark without my escape bag. In desperation, I struggled to establish new anchors. My scene study teacher was the head of my department, and one day after class, I approached her with the reverence of Dorothy addressing Oz. Timidly, I brought up the horrible topic as she shoved scripts into her strand tote. I fumbled with my words, eventually asking her if maybe everything happens for a reason? No, it doesn't. She snapped in irritation, barely looking at me as she abandoned me in the stairwell. 1,000 hot knives pierced my skin, the biggest one through my stomach. I felt shame so intense, it was as if I had caused the attack. I avoided the professor for the rest of my time at school. I was attending their acting program and developed horrible stage fright soon after, painfully derailing my dreams of performing. The pediatrician my parents took me to as a child said my fears were all in my head. The school counselor I saw in 2001 advised me to try to make friends. The therapist I spoke to after giving birth in 2019 claimed worries were normal for new moms. But the psychiatrist I was sent to in 2022 had a new diagnosis. I had OCD and probably had it since childhood. Harm-based OCD is not the same as Monk the Detective refusing to pick up a bloody knife, or Monica Geller organizing her cereal in alphabetical order. OCD, also known as obsessive compulsive disorder, can include such obsessions, but the options don't end there. It can also include fears about doing harm, like unintentionally starting a fire that will wipe out your family home, or causing the end of the world by not remembering to watch for it, or hurting your classmate beyond repair by kicking him too hard in the shin. OCD can run in families. My grandmother was trying to be helpful when she emphatically told me to get rid of those potentially deadly paper cups. There's no telling how many branches of my family tree shared my particular stress. New research points to inflammation exacerbating its symptoms, especially the kind that occurs with strep throat, which I frequently had as a kid. Knowledge and medication isn't always enough, though. It had taken years to find someone to talk to about my anxiety around death, and even longer to put a name to it. Now I had to find a way to live with it. OCD feeds off of what you feel is most important. For me, that was my intense love for people and the deep desire I had to be a protector. My mind was constantly scanning for threats, real or imagined, and creating rituals to prevent them. This had consumed my entire personality. I had to find a way back to myself. Singing, dancing, acting, drawing, and writing were always natural sources of relief for me. My new therapist suggested I use art to form a new healthy ritual, disrupting my mind's cyclone of doom. I was skeptical, but on the last day of winter, I took my sketchbook to Astoria Park. The trees were bare, the ground was cold, but a few brave flowers had begun to bloom in anticipation of spring. I worked in fingerless gloves until my hands froze, drawing a crocus flower, the symbol of rebirth. Inspired, I continued to draw a new flower each day, filling my notebook with individual buds that blossomed in the shadow of the Hellgate Bridge. Flowers, which decay at the end of each season only to bloom again, remind me that death may not always be what it seems. When my father had his heart attack, he asked us to take care of his fig tree. When we uncovered it after its winter sleep, it appeared to be gone, its limbs nothing more than tiny shriveled sticks. But it held on to life. Today, it's doubled in size, giving my now recovered dad plenty of figs for his healthy meals. Yay. It shows me how amazing and enduring real life can be. My brain, incredibly, has taken root to my new habit. It craves the outside, no matter the temperature or the weather. My hands obsess with tiny signs of life in the flowers. Seeds and buds, bugs and blossoms. Harnessing my mind's natural tendencies to explore life in all its bountiful glory. My boy, now 5, has noticed my floral sketchbook and frequently searches for his own plants to draw. I see so much of myself in him, but his bedtime is quite different. He stalls much like I did, but his thoughts don't dwell on the dark. Tell me about when I was a baby, Mama. Tell me about you and Daddy as kids. The more important the question, the longer he knows I will take answer it. One night he asked, Mama, how was the world made? There was a big bang, I say. Then only rocks for a long time. Then plants came. And tiny life you couldn't see. But it grew. He falls asleep as I explain evolution. Days later, we're in the park. He eats ice cream in big, messy chomps, using his free hand to brush through the overgrowth behind the bench. There are so many different grasses, Mama, he exclaims, finding variations in each strand. I marvel at this child, obsessed with life, and I recognize that finally, so am I. Oh, I'm finished. I asked him if he'd like to go inside, but he tells me he'd like to stay a little longer. We remain on our bench under the Hellgate Bridge, and he says, Mama, tell me again how the world came alive.
That's it. Thanks for joining us for this installment of Know You Tell It.
Visit us on the web at knowyoutellit.com.